Good afternoon, everybody. Shul Klotzer coming at you live. Monday, February 20 of the year 23. It's book club time. We're reading the Rav, the World of Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik. I was informed by sheerenjoyment.com that some of the recording was really not heard, was not audible at or around page 42. So although I thought we got to page 46 successfully, we apparently did not. Let's go back to page 42. And we'll do a reread of that. We'll catch everybody up. We're going to start again on page 42 when the recording apparently ended last week. So here it is. Maybe you didn't hear it. If you didn't, I'm really sorry. If you did, this will be a very quick review and no harm done. The question was, would Rabbi Soloveitchik render an offer to succeed his father, Rabbi Moshe Soloveitchik, who had been the Rosh Yeshiva of Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan Theological Seminary? That was the question. Let me read you, a historian noted as follows. Would Soloveitchik accept such a half-hearted invitation? Because they were offering him 1 year, during which time he was to prove his usefulness. Imagine the chutzpah, one of the great rabbis of the day. And they say to him, we have a 1-year contract for you. Prove to us if you can be useful. So, would Soloveitchik accept such a half-hearted invitation? This is written by a historian. Rabbi Goldstein felt that he would. He reported to the board that he discussed just such a possibility with the young scholar and had been moved by Soloveitchik's reply. Quote, if he could not be useful, he would not want to stay there. End quote. 1 month later, the board subcommittee announced that Joseph B. Soloveitchik had accepted the non-tenured post. No subsequent contract renewal discussions were ever held. As it turned out, Rabbi Soloveitchik over the next four decades would exceed the expectations of even his strongest early supporters at Yeshiva and make his initial detractors look most unnecessarily troubled, even as he presented problems for those who would turn Yeshiva's clock back or challenge its subsequent initiatives. The Rav, however, was not engaged, end quote. So he accepted it and he exceeded all expectations. The Rav, however, was not engaged to replace the late Rabbi Revel, who was, of course, the president of Yeshiva at the time, the New York Yeshiva, or, you know, what was it called? In his time, by this time in early 1940s, if I'm not mistaken, it was known as Yeshiva College. That's what I think it was known as. That was, I think, its official name. The Rav, however, was not engaged to replace the late Rabbi Revel, who had been the president. It was not until the spring of 1943 that the Yeshiva's board discharged its prime responsibility with the election of Rabbi Samuel Belkin, who was born 1911 and passed in 1976. As the second president of the yeshiva. Arriving in the United States in 1929, so he was 18 years old at the time, Belkin had received his PhD degree from Brown University in 1935, when he was all of 24 years old. Dr. Belkin and the Rav were to amicably support each other and nurture the evolution of the school during the ensuing decades. Perhaps the only real point of contention occurred in 1970 when Yeshiva University undertook the revision of its charter. In order to qualify for state funding at that time, the Yeshiva had to reconstitute itself as formally non-sectarian. For this reason, the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary had to be officially separated from the university. Henceforth, it would be only an affiliate of Yeshiva University. Some of the rabbinic students were fearful that the new legal situation would diminish the centrality of the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary in the YU complex. During the rabbinic ordination celebrations in April of 1970, the Rav passionately spoke of his fears about the future as a result of the charter revision in a direct confrontation with Dr. Belkin. Subsequently, top page 43. Subsequently, a meeting of minds was reached between Rabbi Soloveitchik and Belkin. Mechanisms were evolved to ensure that the university not appear ambiguous in its intention to safeguard its religious character. The Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary was to remain the focal point of the institution. We're on page 43 of the book, The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. So we see that Rabbi Soloveitchik and Rabbi Belkin had a little bit of a skirmish over here about the spinning off, if you will, of wheat of the Rabbi Isaac Elkanan Theological Seminary from Yeshiva University in order to get state funding. But they eventually had a meeting of the minds. And Reitz was to remain the focal point of the institution. And really, to this day, I did not go to YU. My brother went to YU. He went there for the last 3 years of high school, then went to Israel for 2 years, and then went off to Yeshiva University, and he got his undergraduate degree there. And he studied under Rabbi Tendler, Moshe David Tendler as a tzal. And the impression I got and I still get from my dealings with friends and, friends who went there, family members who went there maybe, is that Reitz is indeed the focal point of the school. I mean, it is the heart and soul of the university. It is the core of YU. It is where the action is taking place. It's where people are getting ordained as rabbis. It's where the faculty puts much of it. Obviously, it teaches undergraduates also, no doubt about that. But if you're in a smicha class and you want to attend a shir, you're able to do that. You can go to a typical shir offered by a rabbi on the faculty of, say, the Mazer Yeshiva program, the MYP, as you're going towards your smicha, which is a five-year program. Not sure of all the details as to how it works, but you can sit in this rabbi shir and that rabbi shir as you're proceeding towards your ordination. So indeed, the yeshiva's Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanan is very much at the core of Yeshiva University even till today. Page 43, the Rav delivered his first lecture as his father's successor on May 13, 1941. Many local rabbis, including principal members of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis and erudite laymen, were present in the yeshiva's Bet Midrash on this occasion. In this initial discourse, the new Rosh Yeshiva analyzed the Talmudical discussion of, quote, a buyer acquires the right to the debt as soon as the bond is delivered to him. The Sugya in Baba Basra 75b. Thus began a new epoch in the yeshiva's history in which the Rav became its focal sage and mentor. He was to continue his lectures at the yeshiva until illness forced his retirement in 1985. So I was in college in 1980 to 1984 at NYU, New York University. It didn't even occur to me, sadly. It just did not occur to me to travel up to YU and to sit in on a class, explore the campus, look around, eat in the restaurant, go into the Beis Medrash, go to Rabbi Soloveitchik Shir. It didn't even occur to me, and for that I'm embarrassed. I just am. I could have seen him in action. I could have heard his voice. I could have seen the shir. Could have done that. And indeed, I did not. I should have done that. In his yeshiva classroom, he remained the quintessential Rosh Yeshiva, and his lectures were in the classic brisk tradition. In this setting, there was little hint of his far-reaching knowledge of numerous cognate subjects. Essentially, it was the Talmud, Maimonides, and the basic early commentaries that remained at the center of the Rav's lectures in the yeshiva for the ensuing 44 years. Imagine giving shiur in the yeshiva for 44 years. That is incredible. And he would stay in New York, my understanding is, I think on campus during the week, and then he would take the Amtrak back to Boston, back to his home in Boston, and arrive either Thursday night or Friday and spend Shabbos in Boston, at the Maimonides School, which he had founded years before, or exactly when, we have to look that up. We did discuss the Maimonides School. And so that was where the Rav lived, and that's where he gave shiur. In the early decades of his teaching, I'm still on page 43, in the early decades of his teaching, the Rav was very demanding in his classroom and could be severely critical of students who did not utilize their full ability. With the passage of time, he gradually mellowed and became much more tolerant of his students' shortcomings. One of the Rav's students in this period later wrote about his classroom experiences. Quote, "To have heard his Talmudic lectures for 3 years in a class of some 20 rabbinical students is to have seen a gaon at work. His discourses ran to about 3 hours without pause. No one fidgeted or budged. He was absolutely riveting. To follow his argument was to be caught up in an intellectual adventure that accelerated one's pulse beat. One's attention could not stray for an instant, or he would be lost for the balance of the Rav shiur." Top page 44. "We had no time for note-taking. So mortgaged was our concentration on the intricate and interconnected pattern of the Rav's presentation. Immediately after he was done, we would all get together in a corner of the Beit HaMidrash to pool our conceptions of what was said and to fill each other in on what might have been missed or miscomprehended. These were magical times for us, students of the Rav. A sense of triumph pervaded us when, after hours of discussion, we thought we had finally got it right." That's amazing. 3 hour classes every day for 44 years? This man was a stupendous giant of epic proportion. Originally, the Rav gave 2 weekly lectures in the yeshiva. This increased to 3 in his last 2 active decades. So he gave shiur 3 times a week. There were fewer students in his original classes because of the relatively small size of the yeshiva. Please. By the late 1960s, however, there were over 100 students in every class. Among them were graduates of Yeshiva University and other American yeshivas. The Rav's lectures served as a magnet for some of the keenest young Talmudic scholars who were desirous of mastering the oral rabbinic tradition. Intuitively, these students felt that the Rav was one of the last living links on American soil with the spiritual world of Volozhin and Brisk. The Rav's class in later years was thus described by a disciple. Quote, "It was around 11 in the morning. The classroom was packed with students, well over 100 in all. We surrounded his desk on 3 sides, the object being to get as close to the front as possible. The shiur began. At first, the Rav's voice was barely audible. Those in the back rows strained to hear what he was saying. They could not. Yet they knew not to panic, for within a matter of moments, the problem would be solved. It always was. As the shiur progressed daily, we witnessed this miracle of transformation. Our frail Rebbe, on in years, and sapped of his strength by poor health and the tragic losses which he had sustained became increasingly animated. His voice grew steadily stronger, and his whole mood seemed to change. Close to 3 hours later, when the shear would end, we were usually mentally drained and hungry for lunch. He, on the other hand, was energetic and anxious to continue even longer. Amazing. Top page 45. Was this an amazing man? 3 hours shear? 3 hours? 3 times a week? We continue. Top page 45. His position at Yeshiva University did the most to project Rabbi Soloveitchik into prominence upon the Jewish scene. He became the spiritual mentor of the majority of the American-trained Orthodox pulpit rabbis. Many were ordained by him in his capacity as a member of the yeshiva's ordination board. Here he was joined by the president of the yeshiva, Rabbi Samuel Belkin, and the former spiritual leader of Lomża, Poland, Rabbi Moshe Staczkis, who was born 1881 and who passed in 1958. So he would ordain young musmachim, as would also Rabbi Samuel Belkin would join him in the ordination, and the former spiritual leader of Lomża in Poland, Rabbi Moshe Staczkis. The latter had come to the United States in 1941 and became a senior member of the yeshiva's faculty. In addition to his lectures in the yeshiva proper, the Rav also served as professor of Jewish philosophy in the Bernard Revel Graduate School of Yeshiva University. Although his activities at the New York Institution became more and more time-consuming, Rabbi Soloveitchik continued to reside in Boston and commuted to New York each week. He never moved to New York. He didn't move to Washington Heights. He didn't move to the Upper West Side. He didn't move to Borough Park, Flatbush. He didn't go to those places in Muncie. He stayed in Boston. His achievements at Yeshiva University became the central facet of the Rav's spiritual personality. Time and again, he would stress that his calling in life was to be a melamed, a teacher. He succeeded in raising more than two generations of students who related to him as their Rebbe Muvok, their prime Torah mentor. My younger brother looks at Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, that's all, as his Rebbe Muvok. Rabbi Moshe David Tendler, that's all, was on the Yeshiva University faculty as both Rosh Hashiva, offer Nagir Magid Shir of Talmud in the mornings, and then he was also a professor of biology at Yeshiva College. He was doing that. He was offering Shir, I think, as soon as he got his smicha at YU. He got his smicha from Rabbi Yitzchak Elkanan. The question is, when? When did he get that? I thought in the 1950s, not 101% certain. But I thought he was ordained in the 1950s at Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanan, got his PhD at Columbia in biology, and then joined the faculty in that respect. So he was a faculty member of the Judaics department at YU, and also he was on the faculty of secular studies at YU. He was a man for all seasons, Rabbi Tendler, as was Rabbi Soloveitchik. Gifted, intellectually giant. These people, intellectual giants of epic proportions. I keep on saying that, but I can't think of any other words to describe these men. We continue in the book. And you know what? When we're done with Rabbi Soloveitchik in this book, and hopefully volume 2, then maybe we can also say that we are, as well, students of Rabbi Soloveitchik. I feel I'm a student of David Feinstein, and from him, from Moshe Feinstein, and other rabbanim in my life. But I also want to be a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik. So together we can hopefully do that. We'll be taught by him in these beautiful lessons that we'll have in this book. But you got to be patient. Here we go. We'll continue. Just getting to know him. That's critical. Despite the changes in the sociological, educational, religious, and economic backgrounds of the yeshiva's student body during this period of 44 years, of 1941 to 1985, Rebbe Soloveitchik became their mentor and was able to relate to them within the context of their backgrounds. In 1960, he switched from Yiddish to English as the language of instruction in his classroom and in most of his public lectures. He made the adjustment with a flourish, with a Yiddish accent accompanying his soft-spoken, high-pitched tone. He utilized the English language to paint portraits of Torah, Talmud, philosophy, theology, mathematics, physics, and Western scholarship with academic and flowery prose. He successfully translated the Brisker terminology into the English idiom. What a man. Top of page 46. While at the yeshiva, the Rav continued to be active in the Union of Orthodox Rabbis of the U.S. and Canada. Founded in 1902, this rabbinic fellowship had united the Eastern European rabbis who ministered to the American Jewish immigrant community. However, gradually the Rav became more active in the Rabbinical Council of America, the RCA. The latter organization, the RCA, had evolved from the yeshiva's rabbinical alumni organization and the rabbinical council of the OU, the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America. In 1935, these bodies merged, that is to say, YU's rabbinical alumni organization and the rabbinical council of the OU. These two organizations merged, and most American-trained rabbis joined the newly formed Rabbinical Council of America, which is popularly known as the RCA. The 1952 annual convention, I'm in the middle of page 46, the 1952 annual convention of the RCA passed a resolution directing the officers to study the possibility of establishing a joint Va'ad Halacha, or Halacha Commission, with the Union of Orthodox Rabbis. However, this proposal proved to be a fleeting fantasy. The chasm between the two Orthodox rabbinic organizations was simply too wide. A joint Va'ad Halacha would have implied at least a degree of recognition of the rabbinical council of the RCA by the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, which is the old school European, Eastern European rabbis. This degree of recognition of the RCA, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis was not prepared to do. The RCA therefore decided to revitalize its own Halacha Commission, and on January 20th, 1953, the RCA appointed the Rav as its chairman. Later that year, the RCA announced that Rabbis Samuel Belkin and Chaim Heller would serve as co-chairmen of the commission. These appointments enhanced the RCA's stature. And this is where I thought we left off last week. We continue. Bottom page 46. In this new post, Rabbi Soloveitchik was to wield a decisive influence on the RCA. Among his memorable decisions as chairman of the Halacha Commission was his unequivocal opposition to mixed seating in synagogues. He went so far as to prohibit listening to the shofar and Rosh Hashanah in such synagogues. The Rav advised praying at home without hearing the shofar, rather than worshiping in such a shul. Later, Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote, top page 47, quote, "To make absolutely clear my position on this laden question I would like to relate this incident. A young man moved into a suburb of Boston where the only existing synagogue had men and women sitting together. He asked me what he should do on the high holidays, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Until then, on account of the mixed seating, he had not entered the synagogue. But in the days of awe, he was very reluctant to remain at home. I answered him that it was better for him to pray at home, both Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and not cross the threshold of that synagogue. A few days later, he telephoned me again. He had met the man who was to sound the shofar in that synagogue, and this man had warned him that if he did not come to the synagogue, he simply would not hear the shofar at all, for the man would not sound the shofar again privately for his benefit. The young man practically implored me that I grant him permission to enter the edifice, at least for a half hour, that he might hear the shofar blast. I hesitated not for a moment, but directed him to remain at home. It would be better not to hear the shofar than to enter a synagogue whose sanctity has been profaned. End quote. Middle page 47. Although he vigorously opposed innovations in the synagogue and the traditional prayer service, the Rub did not advocate a total break with the Reform and conservative movements, despite their unacceptable innovations. Rabbi Soloveitchik did not agree with the public ruling issued in 1956 by 11 leading American Rosh Yeshiva, which prohibited rabbis and synagogues from membership in groups which also included non-Orthodox clergymen and synagogues. That is, if I recall, we're going to see it in a minute, the Synagogue Council of America, I think. So it seems that in 1956, 11 American Rosh Yeshivas prohibited rabbis and shuls from membership in the Synagogue Council of America, because they also included non-Orthodox clergymen and synagogues. Over the years, the Rav clarified his position. He agreed with the Rosh Yeshiva that on matters of halacha, no cooperation was possible with the non-Orthodox movements. On issues involving relations with the non-Jewish world, however, matters which he termed klapei chutz, external affairs, where vital Jewish interests were at stake, division in the Jewish camp would endanger the entire Jewish community. He therefore held that limited cooperation was desirable. It was reported that, quote, he was grateful that the attempt to leave the synagogue council was defeated, end quote, at an RCA convention in the early 1960s. How about that? He felt that limited cooperation with Reform and conservative was desirable. He was therefore grateful that the attempt to leave the Synagogue Council of America was defeated at an RCA convention in the early 1960s. Top of page 48. As he had put it years earlier, in an interview published in a New York Yiddish daily, The Jewish Day, in November of 1954, quote, when representation of Jews and Jewish interests klapei chutz, meaning towards the outside, with a look towards the outside, meaning involving non-Jewish people, when representation of Jews and Jewish interests klapei chutz are involved, all groups and movements must be united. There can be no divisiveness in this area, for any division in the Jewish camp can endanger its entirety. In the crematoria, the ashes of the pious and those filled with praiseworthy deeds mingled with the ashes of radicals and freethinkers. We must jointly fight against the enemy who does not recognize the difference between one who worships and one who does not. End quote. It's an amazing attitude to take. The other American Rosh Yeshiva just did not see it that way. They felt that it was very important to not give even an inch to recognition of Reform and conservative institutions, even if we're dealing with the outside world. We're just not going to show any, we're not going to acknowledge them. They just don't exist to us. We're not going to work in tandem with them.
Why is the people who call themselves the pious, why would they be in the crematorium?
Mendel wants to know, why would the ashes of the pious be in the crematoria?
If they're only the ones who are going to be buried, they're not the ones who are
going to
be burned.
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question fully, but Mr. Soloveitchik's point is the Nazis really did not care how religious you were, how non-religious you were. Were you davening in a frum, in an Orthodox shul? Did you pray in a Reform temple with the choir and the organ, and your minister was when your rabbi is decked out like a Protestant minister? Or did you daven like a Hasidic Jew in a cloise? The Nazis didn't care. They were killing every Jew inside that they could get their hands on. And so in a crematoria, the ashes of one mixed with the ashes of another. That was Rabbi Soloveitchik's point. And at the end of the day, our enemies don't care how frum we are individually. So Rabbi Soloveitchik felt that because that's true, there should be no divisions. There should be like a unified Jewish response to certain things that happen in the outside world that'll impact Jews and their communities in America. And that's how he felt about it, that there should be a unified Jewish response to outside invasions or influencers and things like that. Today, it just seems to me that today we've got such a fractured Jewish community. Most are apathetic and ignorant, and they don't affiliate at all. They know nothing about anything. And then you've got, on the one hand, you've got Orthodox Jews who are very, very educated. And on the other hand, you've got Reform Jews who know basically nothing, can't read much Hebrew. Whatever they know how to read, they can't translate. They never studied Torah. They don't know very much. And your heart goes out. And the Reform and Conservative today are led by the New York Times and the Washington Post and the legacy media. They're about as woke as it gets. They are fully in favor of gay rights. And they embrace every possible woke initiative, from critical race theory to equity. And they're basically Marxists in some respect. They're social Marxists. And it's painful to say it. But ultra-liberal Jews in America are indeed in that camp. They've been hijacked by the Democrats, who are hardcore left-wing Marxists, the Bernie Sanders group, which seems to have won the day in the Democrat Party. So you have capitalists versus Marxists in this country now. So that's not a Jewish community of any unity. Maybe there was more unity 60 years ago, but we don't have that today at all. So maybe in his time it was valuable and it was possible, and they were able to speak with one voice. But today, with the woke ism being what it is, there's just simply no way that American Orthodoxy, which rails against a homosexual lifestyle, can come to terms with gay rights and the LGBTQ group and Black Lives Matter and Antifa and social and economic equity and ESG and every other imaginable thing. There's just no way that these two communities can speak with one voice. It just doesn't happen anymore. That's the way it is. Life has changed. In continuing, we're on page 48. In consonance with the Rub's viewpoint, the RCA continued its association with the Synagogue Council during the ensuing decades until the organization ceased its activities in 1994. That's when the Synagogue Council of America broke apart and was no longer. Probably because there was just too much tension between Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. Yeah, I don't have the exact remembrance. I do remember living through it, but I don't remember anymore exactly why it broke apart. If you had to ask me, it would be because it's just untenable. Reform is getting so liberal, and Orthodoxy was going to the right, and in the middle is conservatism, and they eventually linked up with Reform. It just was not a tenable organization to keep afloat anymore. Continuing, mid page 48. In the mid-1950s, the Rub was actively involved in negotiations with the Conservative Rabbinical Assembly regarding a joint Orthodox and conservative Besdin. Imagine that. In the 1950s, Mr. Soloveitchik himself was actively involved in negotiating with the Conservative Rabbinical Assembly, the RA. That, of course, is the conservative equivalent of the RCA. Regarding a joint Orthodox and conservative Besdin. Picture that. This court was to supervise the areas of personal status and guide their enactments in conformity with the halacha. In particular, the joint Besdin was to administer the preparation, execution, and delivery of divorces. Gittin. The plan called for the initial members of the Besdin to be appointed by the Rav and Professor Shaul Lieberman, who was born 1898 and passed in 1983, of the Jewish Theological Seminary, another man I theoretically could have met. The latter, that is to say, Professor Shaul Lieberman, get this, and those of you who know, know it, but those of you who don't, listen to this. Professor Shaul Lieberman of the JTS, the conservative flagship institution, Professor Rabbi Shaul Lieberman was married to Dr. Judith Berlin, the granddaughter of the Netziv, the Enochal, the granddaughter of Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin of Volozhin. The Volozhin of Rosh Yeshiva had a granddaughter, Yehudis. Okay? Yehudis Berlin. She got a PhD, apparently, and she married Rabbi Dr. Shaul Lieberman, who was, of course, another one of these typical Jewish geniuses. Lieberman was a product of Slabodka, one of the great students of Slabodka. Ultimately went on to become the chancellor and or Rosh Yeshiva of Machon Harry Fischel in Jerusalem, Israel, which is pretty well known in Mizrahi and Dati Le'umi and Rav Kook circles for training men to become rabbis, to take the chief rabbi examination or to learn in Kollel after one gets admitted as a rabbi. Imagine the beautiful life one leads of learning Torah in Israel and gets ordained by the chief rabbinate, the rabbinut of Israel. And then you stay on in Kollel in Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh, surrounded by Yerushalayim Shel Zahav. Wow. Just think of that. And many people aspire to it and do it. Imagine the life. What a life. And so, Professor Shaul Lieberman married the granddaughter of the Netziv. And then ultimately he was approached by the conservative school, the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, in Morningside Heights, Manhattan, in New York City. And the school approached Professor Lieberman and said, "What would you most like to do?" He said, "I'd like to sit and learn and publish." They said, "We can make that happen. You become the rector or the chancellor of our rabbinical school and give a shiur, and we'll give you ample time to do your research." He accepted the position, and he moved from Jerusalem to New York City, and he joined the conservative Jewish Theological Seminary of America.
What did he do?
Where he published, among other books, his multi-volume Tosefta Kipshuta, which we have at Gulf Manor Synagogue, donated so graciously by Rabbi Balk. And I looked up, since we're learning Moed Katan, I looked up Tosefta Kipshuta, and I saw that there is a little bit of a dispute, if you will, in the sources between the Talmud and the Tosefta in one particular piece of Tanaitic literature. And I found that fascinating, and I'm not sure how to resolve it. One says the Rav Yehuda said something. The other source said that the Rabbanan said something. He wants the same exact sort, you know, quote. So something to be looked at. But Rabbi Dr. Saul Lieberman, in order to produce that book, had to go to Munich, Vienna, I believe, scoured around New York, and found as many, and London, and Erfurt in Germany. And he found original Kitvei Yad manuscripts. All this is an aside, just to give you an idea as to how great Lieberman was as an intellect and as a scholar. Mendel had a question.
How did he do those manuscripts?
He found those manuscripts in libraries throughout the great libraries of the world.
What happened to them?
They're still in those libraries. He simply maybe made a photocopy or maybe he just memorized them. But in the Tosefta Kipshuta, if I'm not mistaken, there are photocopies of those manuscripts. So clearly he took photos of them. He got permission from the libraries. He had academic credentials. And so he approached the libraries and said, I'm working on a book on Tosefta. Can I please photocopy your materials?
What?
If I'm not mistaken, he also went you might have seen some of the Cairo Geniza, since he was at the seminary, and the seminary was reorganized by Dr. Solomon Schechter in the year 1902, 1903. So, and since Schechter had made his success in Cairo, he was, of course, out of Cambridge University. And when he heard two women talking, I don't know how this story went down, but he overheard a rumor and he spoke to some women who said they saw this incredible amount of stuff in a synagogue in Cairo. He said, I'm on my way. And he went to Egypt, Dr. Solomon Schechter, and he found a treasure trove of either 1,000 years old or 1,500 years old materials in the Cairo Geniza, in the shul, I forgot the name of the shul, the Ibn Ezra shul, Cairo, in Egypt.
What happened to those documents?
Those documents, many of them were transported, if I'm not mistaken, to Cambridge University. He got permission from the synagogue. Remember, it was just in a big room collecting dust, but nobody cared. Along comes an academic scholar who knows all this stuff, and he opens up the door and he says, oh my goodness, this is where my life is going to be spent for the rest of my life. I'm going to make a career out of deciphering the thousands of pieces of paper in this room where people were putting Seamus and now couldn't care less about the room. That room was hundreds and hundreds of years old, Mendel.
Is that room still around?
Yes, it is. If I'm not mistaken, I think the synagogue is still around, not very well attended, because as Rabbi Kunin said recently, there aren't that many shuls that are well attended. Most Egyptian Jews moved to Israel. When things got hot after the state of Israel was founded, the vast majority of Egyptian Jewry moved to Israel. So you've got a shul or two, but they're not very well attended. It's not exactly a growing community in Cairo, Jewishly speaking.
So could they move the synagogue to Israel?
No. They're not going to move the physical building to Israel. We'll wait on Mashiach to do that, or the Almighty will take care of that.
That people actually in India just lift up buildings.
Yeah, but it's not that easy to lift the building and take it over the Suez Canal. So that's probably not going to happen anytime soon. All I could say is this is what he found in the Cairo Geniza, centuries upon centuries and centuries old documents, dating back to the time of Maimonides, 1,000 years old, and it could be that there was older stuff even from then. Huh. So, was he finding Dead Sea Scroll stuff? No. He wasn't finding Dead Sea Scrolls material. I may have misspoken. But he was finding old parchments, I think, from Talmud, and certainly from the time of Maimonides, 11th century, 12th century, and onward.
Was that room still collecting stuff up until when he got it?
Well, it's hard to know that. It could be that people stopped putting stuff in there in the 1800s. But still, we have centuries of material over there. And he had to go through it and make sense out of it. And that's what he spent his entire rest of his life doing. Once he found the Cairo Geniza, he was set for life. He was able to make the rest of his career at Cambridge University. They supported him and paid his fee, paid his wage, and he spent his life deciphering the Cairo Geniza holdings, which was a bonanza for the Jewish people to have an educated man figure out what was written over there. You have contracts, gittin, kiddushin, manuscripts. I mean, it was an absolute treasure trove, the Cairo Geniza.
Why did they leave all those documents, though?
We got to move on. Now, I'm also running out of my knowledge base. To know more would be to know, to have a PhD myself in the Cairo Geniza. And I don't know if I have that. So, I know what I know. And we continue. Lieberman. Yes, so he made his career at the seminary. After the, and we go back to the book, after the initial appointments, the Beis Din would become self-perpetuating, designating its own replacements. It was reported that, quote, Rabbi Soloveitchik is quite impressed with the plan and is ready to support it, end quote. As the negotiations continued, though, it became obvious that the proposal was not workable. The outcome was described by an RCA activist. Quote, at the final meeting between Soloveitchik and Lieberman, the question arose whether the rabbinical assembly would discipline any of its men who did not accept the authority of the national Beis Din. A concrete example raised by Rabbi David Hollander was whether a rabbi performing a marriage of a divorced person without a proper religious divorce could be expelled. Lieberman pleaded with Soloveitchik not to insist on this point because otherwise the entire agreement would collapse. He indicated that once the agreement was in effect, it would eventually be possible to implement such discipline. Rabbi Wolf Kelman, in retrospect, concurred with this opinion and said that the reactions of the various rabbinical assembly committees were initially negative to disciplining members who did not comply with the agreement. Hollander recalled that when he and Soloveitchik left Lieberman's quarters in the early morning hours, they agreed the national Beis Din was stillborn, meaning dead in utero, never going to happen, end quote. I mean, it was stillborn, end quote. We're at the top of page 49. With the advent of the ecumenical thrust of the Catholic Church in the 1960s, of course, they're talking about Vatican Council II, which met in 1962 under Pope John the 23rd and was concluded in 1965 under Pope Paul the 6th. The Rub was consulted regarding Orthodox participation in the dialogue initiated by the Vatican with Jewish leaders. Rabbi Soloveitchik opposed many aspects of this dialogue. He held that there could be no discussion concerning the uniqueness of the respective religious communities. Each, he held, was an individual entity which could not be merged or equated with the other, since each was committed to a different faith. The Rav presented a paper entitled Confrontation on this topic at the 1964 Midwinter Conference of the Rabbinical Council. Its presentation led to the formulation of an RCA policy statement which reflected the Rav's viewpoint. He later published an expanded version of the seminal essay in Tradition magazine, a journal of Orthodox Jewish thought, a journal published by the RCA. Appendix to the Rav's essay was the statement adopted by the RCA at the 1964 conference. But while all this 1964, there was while Vatican II was still going on. Vatican II, as I said to you earlier, was started in 1962 under John the 23rd and ended in 65 under Paul the 6th. So in 1964, the Vatican Council was still going on. It hadn't ended yet. It was going to be next year in 65. And by the way, what does Vatican II say about the Jews anyway? Well, it says that we are the stock of Abraham and we are their older brother in faith. It's not a very long paragraph, but it is a sea change in the theological stance of the Roman Catholic Church towards Jews and Judaism, which they had never felt before. These were new words in their mouths. And I'm reading a book now called From Enemy to Friend, The Revolution in Catholic Teaching, from 1933 to 1965. It was mostly prompted by Jewish converts to Catholicism who were so aghast, they were so appalled at the racism that they found in their new home, the Roman Catholic Church, racism directed at Jews, anti-Semitism still directed at Jews during the 30s. They could not believe it. They had left the Jewish community and they shacked up with the Catholic Church thinking that that's the place to be. Meanwhile, they're confronted by pure, vulgar racism. They just couldn't believe it. And so they tried their best to change it. And in meetings behind closed doors, in writings, they ultimately came on to a new understanding of Paul's epistle to the Hebrews, or is it to the Romans? Got to look that up again. I haven't gotten to that point in the book yet. Either way, one of Paul's epistles, either to the Hebrews or the Romans, where they, I think the Romans, where they reevaluate his writing to make room for the Jews. And so, far from being the perfidious people that they used to pray for every Easter or during Holy Week before Easter, we are perfidious Jews, you know, unfaithful, sinister, backstabbing, perfidious people. We're now the stock of Abraham, and we are the older brother of Abraham, we're their older brother in faith. We can guide them. They can look to us as a model. Incredible. When you consider what the Gospel of John, chapter 8, says, where Jesus himself says that we're the stock of the devil, we're the children of the devil, and if this is any true, if there's any truth to this whole Mishigana chapter, where the Jews and Jesus are screaming at each other, he says, if you're of your father Abraham, he said, yeah, we are of our father Abraham. We're Jews. Abraham is our father. Yeah, well, if you were, you wouldn't be doing what you do. He says, well, and they said, listen, we're not perfect, but we are children of Abraham. No, you're children of Satan. Your father is Satan. They're going, Satan? Are you crazy? I mean, we're Jews, the children of Abraham and Yaakov. Are you out of your mind? And who are you anyway? I mean, I don't know if they asked him that, but they should have. Are you part of us or not? If you're part of us, then you're either satanic or you're from our forefathers. Oh, no, I'm from our God, my Father in heaven. I'm really nuts. I mean, it was such a crazy chapter. The Gospel of John, chapter 8, is a nutty, nutty chapter. But it certainly seems to be upended and ignored by Vatican II, which now says very nice things about the Jewish people. We are indeed the stock of Abraham. So how do you square that? How do you square Vatican II with Jesus, who said that the Jews are of Satan? And now 2,000 years later, the Vatican's coming around and agreeing with the Jews, who are fighting against Jesus. The whole thing is with sugar. When you understand what's going on, it is insane. And, you know, I write this in my comments to Church Militant on their blog, on their website. They always delete it because they have nothing to say about it. They can't explain it. Anyway, I know too much about this nonsense. Here we go. Here's what Rabbi Soloveitchik thought, and this is an expanded version of this of his essay as published in Tradition magazine. It declared, quote, "We are pleased to note that in recent years there has evolved in our country, as well as throughout the world, a desire to seek better understanding and a mutual respect among the world's major faiths. The current threat of secularism and materialism and the modern atheistic negation of religion and religious values makes even more imperative a harmonious relationship among the faiths. This relationship, however, can only be of value if it will not be in conflict with the uniqueness of each religious community, since each religious community is an individual entity which cannot be merged or equated with a community which is committed to a different faith. Each religious community is endowed with intrinsic dignity and metaphysical worth. Its historical experience, its present dynamics, its hopes and aspirations for the future can only be interpreted in terms of full spiritual independence of and freedom from any relatedness to another faith community. Any suggestion that the historical and meta-historical worth of a faith community be viewed against the backdrop of another faith, and the mere hint that a revision of basic historic attitudes is anticipated, are incongruous with the fundamentals of religious liberty and freedom of conscience, and can only breed discord and suspicion. Such an approach is unacceptable to any self-respecting faith community that is proud of its past, vibrant and active in the present, and determined to live on in the future and to continue serving God in its own individual way. Only full appreciation on the part of all of the singular role, inherent worth, and basic prerogatives of each religious community and help promote the spirit of cooperation among faiths. End quote. Middle page 50. Rabbi Soloveitchik's association with the RCA played a pivotal role in the growth of the organization's influence. His presence and guidance provided sukkar and aid for its rabbis, caught up as they were in the difficulty of representing and perpetuating Torah on the American scene. The Rav's more intensive association with the RCA also enabled the organization to take its place alongside the Union of Orthodox Rabbis as a representative of the American Orthodox Rabbinate. A historian wrote of events in this period, quote, "The organization itself, meaning the RCA, underwent its greatest period of growth in the 1950s. The name Soloveitchik added luster and gave the rabbinical council standing, albeit grudgingly, from the other Orthodox groups. His presence gave the organization a stiffer backbone. The Rav forged a singularly intimate," we continue now, "backbone," end quote. "The Rav forged a singularly intimate relationship with Rabbi Israel Klavan, the executive director and then executive vice president of the RCA from 1950 until his death in 1980. Gradually, Klavan became the central figure in the activities of the Rabbinical Council and emerged as one of Orthodoxy's top civil servants. He gave continuity and permanence to the chain of leadership of the RCA, since its elected presidents were limited to a two-year term. Klavan's harmonious association with the Rav was instrumental in the latter's ever-increasing bonds with the Rabbinical Council." One more paragraph. "Notwithstanding," we're on page 51, "notwithstanding public involvements of this kind, the Rav's main sphere of activity remained the classroom and the lecture hall. In addition to his regular teaching schedule, the Rav was also called upon for special lectures. In 1958 to 59, he delivered a series of classes on Jewish social philosophy to a group of social workers in New York. He also was the principal Jewish representative in YU's Institute of Mental Health Project, which was undertaken in 1960 in conjunction with Harvard and Loyola Universities to study religious attitudes towards psychological problems. The lectures delivered to these groups later served as the basis for a portion of his published philosophical writings, particularly The Lonely Man of Faith." Okay, it goes on and on. I have to cut it somewhere. We'll cut it over here. So much more good stuff to come. Do not miss it next week. It ends off, by the way, on page 66, the actual text. Then come the footnotes. Okay. We are going to end it over here. I want to thank everybody for showing up. Thank you so much for calling in. Don't miss us tomorrow night. Tanakh Tuesday, we take a look at Isaiah 7 and probably the famous verse 7, verse 14, a young woman will give birth. There's a lot of Christian and Jewish fighting over that pasuk. We'll see more about it. Everybody have a great day. Zayitz Gezunt, Shul Plaska, signing off. The Gulf Meadows Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.